Ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, good evening. My name is Britta Zeuching-Jude. I'm the Dean of the Law Faculty of the University of Vienna, and I would like to warmly welcome you to today's exclusive lecture organized by Wieso Austria. The political situation in Israel and the Gaza Strip in particular has preoccupied the whole world since the terrorist attacks of October 2023 at the latest. Searching for a solution of the conflict naturally raises numerous legal questions, particularly in the areas of international law and human rights. Above all, however, it is important to develop an understanding of the causes of the conflict and the views of those affected. The university has always been and should always be a place where constructive dialogue takes place. Against this background, several events on this topic have already been organized at the University of Vienna, and today the focus will be on the Israeli perspective, which is somehow still missing in the dialogue here at the university. And I'm very pleased that we have one of the most sought-after speakers today, Ms. Einat Wilf, whom I warmly welcome. I will not take too much time and hand over to Ms. Isolde Vogel, who will introduce Ms. Wilf in more detail and moderate the event. I wish you all and wish us all an exciting and interesting evening. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. It's so nice to see so many of you here today. My name is Isolde Vogel, and I'm a researcher on anti-Semitism at the Documentation Center of Austrian Resistance, das Dokumentationsarchiv des österreichischen Widerstandes, here in Vienna, in the Department of Far-Right Studies, and I have the pleasure to moderate today's discussion and event. First things first, we are grateful to the University of Vienna. Thank you, Dean of the Faculty of Law, Brigitta Zöchling, and thank you also, Daniel Rubin, for making this event today possible. And now, before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge our hosts, the Wieso Austria, Wieso Österreich, and especially the honorary chairwoman, Ehrenpräsidentin Chava Bugaya-Gleitmann. And Rita Dauber also, who both organized today's event. Thank you. Now I'd like to take a few minutes to introduce the Wieso and the Wieso's work to you. Wieso stands for Women's International Zionist Organization and is the largest Jewish women's organization with around 100,000 members worldwide in 38 countries. It is nonpartisan and holds a consultative status as an NGO at the United Nations here in Vienna. Its founding is closely linked to the history of Zionism and the establishment of the State of Israel. So WISO was founded in 1920 in London by pioneering Zionist feminists Rebecca Sief and Dr. Vera Weizmann. And their vision then was really groundbreaking. It was a vision to empower women as equal partners in building society, specifically in what was then British Mandate Palestine. Soon, many more branches were established across Europe. Among them was Austria, where the Wieso existed from 1921 until the dissolution of all Jewish organizations following the Nazi takeover in 1938. With the re-establishment of the Jewish community after 1945, also the Wieso Austria was re-established. Today, Wieso continues its nonpartisan humanitarian mission in Israel and worldwide. And it is, as I said, a nonprofit organization Much of its work is carried out by dedicated women volunteering their time and effort to make this work possible. The focus remains on equal opportunities, particularly for underprivileged groups and immigrants, and this commitment extends to all communities in Israel, so this also means, of course, Druze, Bedouin, and Arab-Israeli families. The social and political connection to Israel remains at the core of WISO's mission worldwide, as well as the fight of all forms of discrimination, of course, including anti-Zionism and also the fight against anti-Zionism. WISO Austria is also an important part of Vienna's Jewish community. And regarding the response of WISO since the horrific events of October 7th, the organization has played a crucial role in helping families from the south to the north of Israel, where communities have been forced to flee. Many children have been left deeply traumatized, we know that, and not only the recent events, but years of living under constant rocket fire and emergency evacuations. WISO has therefore established schools and kindergartens and youth centers that even under rocket alarms are able to operate, and has built reinforced shelters in all of its facilities to protect these children. So to sum it up, WISO Austria and the entire WISO network embodies a long-standing commitment to education, social justice, and humanitarian support. Their work continues to be essential, especially in times of crisis, ensuring that women, children, and families receive the care, protection, and the opportunities they need. So before we move on, I really want to thank WISO and express my appreciation of the organization and, of course, also Chava again for organizing today's event. Now, as someone researching in the field of anti-Semitism studies, I find today's topic especially exciting for myself and for my own work. My studies or my research actually focuses on the persistence of Völkisch and National Socialist worldviews in modern forms and also in modern forms of anti-Semitism. I often encounter in a kind of public skepticism to the current urgency of this topic and general the questions of the continuity of anti-Semitism. And as you can see, today's lecture aims to explore international reactions after October 7th. And I want to make clear that this, of course, directly affected Israeli and Jewish communities worldwide. But the reactions to October 7th even had a bigger global impact and global challenges we face today. The ideological threat posed by terrorist organizations and their supporters, they are deeply anti-liberal, anti-democratic, and anti-emancipatory stands in direct opposition to the values of open and free societies and is therefore an issue that affects the entire world and everybody. Understanding these dynamics is crucial not only for those immediately affected, but for anyone committed to democracy, human rights, and the fight against anti-Semitism. And I'm really glad we have this opportunity today to discuss and explore this important issue together. Now, let me introduce our distinguished speaker of today, Dr. Einat Wilf. Einat Wilf studied in Harvard, INSEAD in France, and at the University of Cambridge. She was a Goldman visiting professor at Georgetown University and is a leading thinker of Israel Zionism, foreign policy and education. Born and raised in Israel, Einat was a member of the Israeli Parliament from 2010 to 2013. She served as an intelligence officer at the IDF and was a foreign policy advisor to Vice Prime Minister Shimon Peres and a strategic consultant. And as far as I know, at least hasn't been to Vienna since some time. She's also the author of 7 books that explore key issues of the Israeli society. For example, We Should All Be Zionists, that was published in 2022. and brings together her essays from the past 4 years on Israel, Zionism, and the path to peace. And she's also co-author of The War of Return that was published in 2020. The lecture will approximately last for 30 minutes, followed by a short interview and then an open Q&A session. So make sure to take notes. You will get the chance to ask your questions later on. The lecture is being recorded and will be published, so make sure to wait for the microphone to arrive at your place before you ask your questions later on. And with that, I'm very keen to give the floor to Einat Wilf. Please welcome her.
Thank you so, so much. It's truly an honor to be here. I'm thankful that we could make it work, and truly a pleasure to be here. So I have to share with you that I think there are few places that I would be more honored to speak in than the Faculty of Law in the University of Vienna. And the reason is... And the reason is that one of my favorite people of all time came to study here many, many years ago, moving from Budapest to Vienna, thinking he will be a fabulous playwright in the German language. His name, of course, is Theodor Herzl. You know him as the visionary of the modern state of Israel. As I'm sure you know, that was not his life plan. He wanted to be a Viennese German playwright. So today I had a few hours and I went to the Leopold Museum to look at the exhibition of Vienna in the 1900s. And they had a wall there of Vienna's intellectual heyday. And when I tell people, when I give a talk about the history of the modern state of Israel, the history of Zionism, I always tell people there are few better places and times to live than Vienna at the end of the 19th century. If you're going to choose anywhere, anytime to live, Vienna at the end of the 19th century is certainly one of those places. And you look at that wall in the Leopold Museum and everything from how we think about chemistry and physics and literature and psychology and the arts to the present day, those ideas were hashed at the cafes of Vienna. So at this moment, when Vienna experiences its intellectual heyday, where to be Jewish was to be Viennese. Where much of Vienna is Jewish, much of what it means to be Jewish is Vienna. At that moment, Herzl goes to study law. He is accepted to one of the most prestigious fencing clubs, Albia. As far as he's concerned, he's done. He's made it. This is the moment of belonging, of emancipation, of being in. And at that moment, among his colleagues, among the educated, among the elites, among the students of the Faculty of Law in Vienna, he sees the rise of this new old ideology of anti-Semitism. And amazingly, Herzl realizes before everyone where this is going to lead. And this requires a particular kind of genius to look at the most successful moment and place in Jewish modern history and to say, this is heading for disaster. And often when I give talks to young people, what I struggle with is to let them know that anti-Semitism at the end of the 19th century was a respectable ideology. One of the biggest problems I have with young people, especially in the West, is that they are so smug. They believe that they would see it coming from a mile away. They are too smart, too educated, too knowledgeable to ever fall for it, not realizing that they are falling for it as we speak. So they don't realize that at the time, at the end of the 19th century here, anti-Semitism was respectable. It was in books. The educated, the elites, they held those views. And that mattered. Because nothing bad can happen unless the educated people believe in it. And what we're seeing, I want to argue, is that we are experiencing right now a similar moment in the West. When Jewish belonging is at its height, when to be American is to be Jewish is to be American, that so much what is considered Western and American culture has been shaped by Jews. At this moment, to see that something sinister is brewing, and I would even make the claim that it has nothing to do with Israel and nothing to do with Palestinians. What is being created is a 360 environment that brings back one of the most ancient and most dangerous ideas, generally, but certainly when it comes to Jews. The idea that the world would be a far better place without the collective Jew. And I'll explain how that is being built, and why universities, media, international organizations are the foundation stones of building that worldview. I want to give an acknowledgement to Tsarist Russia and the Soviet Union. I say that they do not get enough credit for their contribution of taking Judaism global. They should get a lot of credit. As I'm sure you know, Tsarist Russia literally wrote the book, right? The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, claiming to be the protocols of the first Zionist Congress. Now, today, anyone can publish a book, no big deal. But imagine 120 years ago, a book was a serious thing. So imagine to see all these lies and libels that were floating around appear in a book. That's serious. That's respectable. It's a book. It's no coincidence that this book has never been out of print and is available in every language in the world. But certainly in my region, in the Arab world, this is not considered a forgery. I've been told by diplomats, Western diplomats, that they get this book as a gift from their Arab colleagues so that they will know what's really going on. So Tsarist Russia literally wrote the book on anti-Semitism. Nazi Germany didn't invent much. They pretty much used it as ideas very effectively, but really didn't create them. So, as I say, Hitler gave anti-Semitism a bad name, and now the Soviet Union, as heir to the Tsarist Russia, is stuck. First of all, they were officially against Tsarist Russia, so they were officially people like Lenin, they were against anti-Semitism. But now they even did better. They just defeated the Nazis. You don't get to be more anti-Semitic than having just defeated the Nazis. So, now they create something else. They create anti-Zionism as its respectable mask. And now, it's not just a book. It's an entire academic discipline where people write essays and they reference each other. And I'm sure if you're in academia, at one point there's so many cross-references, you can't know that all of this is a bunch of libels. It becomes respectable. And it gets exported through left-wing Marxist circles to Western academia, from there to the Anglo-academia where it flourishes today. And what the Soviets have created is ingenious. They're smart to their credit. And what they've created is something simple and effective. I've come to call it the placard strategy, because you see it in anti-Israel placards, maybe here on your streets. The placards are very simple. They're visually powerful. They're built like equations. They say Israel, Zionism. Sometimes they just draw a Star of David. Then there will be an equation sign. And the placard strategy has been so successful that I doubt any of you have seen a placard that says Zionism equals the political movement for self-determination and liberation of the Jewish people in their ancestral homeland. It's a long placard, but it would be the only accurate. But the placard strategy has been so successful that I bet you all know what's on the other side of the equation sign. Israel, Zionism, Star of David equals imperialism, colonialism, racism, apartheid. Then it will escalate. Ethnic cleansing, Nazism, genocide, Holocaust. If you happen to be an American in 2020, suddenly it will say Zionism equals white supremacy. This gives you a clue to how the placard strategy works. The placard strategy is not about describing reality. You only need to be 30 seconds in Israel to know that. The placard strategy, if anything, is the inversion of reality. Zionism is the most anti-imperialist decolonization movement. The Jews have battled against apartheid, of course against genocide. Oh, man, it's an inversion of reality. But it claims to be a description of reality. But that's not the reason those words are chosen. Those words are chosen because they have become universally synonymous with evil. And this is why all of a sudden in 2020 in America, when white supremacy rises to become the evil of the moment, based on the Black Lives Matter moment, then suddenly white supremacy, with exactly zero logic, appears next to the word Zionism. And what the placard strategy does so effectively is implant into people's minds this nursery rhyme repetition: Israel, Zionism, Star of David equals evil. Israel, Zionism, Star of David equals evil. Now, the genius of the placard strategy is that it's not only on placards. Give an anti-Israel speaker 30 seconds on television, they will manage to say racism, apartheid, genocide, regardless of the question. Listen, once you see it, and once I had a diplomat, I walked him through the placard strategy a few years ago. He came back to me and said, Einat, once you see it, you can't unsee it. So it's on television, media, social media. But here's where it gets interesting and important. It's in academia. You can get a PhD for Zionism as colonialism. You will get tenure for saying that Israel is an apartheid state. And this will be laundered through the most hallowed post-World War II institutions. Why did Zionism as racism come to the UN General Assembly vote in 1975? This is literally a placard strategy resolution. It's one of the shortest resolutions of the UN. We are hereby resolved. Zionism is a form of racism. Why? What happened in 1975? Did they sit and think and research and say, okay, we've come to the conclusion that Zionism is racism, let the UN General Assembly decide? No. What happens is two major developments. One, the UN moves to be a place of many, many countries. When Israel, the partition resolution passes in the UN General Assembly in 1947, there are 51 countries. Today, there are 200. And this process was very quickly happening in the 60s and 70s, leading Abba Ibn, our legendary ambassador to the UN, to remark that if Algeria, it's still always Algeria, that if Algeria were to promote a resolution that the earth is flat and that Israel had flattened it, it would pass by a majority of 136, 13 against, and 26 abstentions. Those are still pretty much the numbers. So the UN General Assembly becomes a place that you can literally pass any vote you want, certainly against Israel. And earlier, the UN General Assembly resolved that racism is bad, that it's going to fight racism. So if everyone agrees that racism is bad, next step is, let's stick racism next to Zionism. So that is the process. First, something becomes acknowledged as a universal evil, then you put it on the climate strategy. And you launder it through international institutions, which, despite my best efforts, still retain the halo of their foundational principles. You know, there's this body called the UN Human Rights Commission. You're hearing those five words, the United Nations Human Rights Commission. You imagine some elderly men and women sitting around the table thinking how to better the situation of human rights in the world. You are not thinking Libya, Qatar, China. Well, that's the UN Human Rights Commission. And they are obsessed with Israel. They have a permanent element to always discuss Israel, the only country, and they issue constant reports and resolutions against Israel. But nobody knows that. So people hear the UN Human Rights Commission said this. Ah, this must be true. This must be serious. This is respectable. Taking the case of genocide to the International Court of Justice. Nobody cares what they rule. There was an interview with the woman who was in charge of judges or something, and she said, look, we didn't say that Israel was committing genocide. Who cares? If you can say genocide, International Court of Justice, you're done. Now it's respectable. Now every educated person can believe that what they're saying is serious, is true. So launder it through the UN, through the ICC, through the ICJ, the absolute same playbook. Now, why is it so important to launder it through academia, the so-called human rights organization, through the UN? Recently, I saw a video with a former Soviet operative who talked about how you create mass manipulation. He talked about repetition. He talked about that. He talked about visual symbols. The climate strategy is very visual, simple, and powerful. He talked about emotions. But what I found most interesting is he had the following phrase. He said, prestige paralyzes judgments. Prestige paralyzes judgment. Now, for years I talked about how important respectability was to the strategy of inserting this idea. But when he said it, I was like, bingo. Prestige paralyzes judgment. If Colombia says something, if Harvard says something, if the UN level says something, well, prestige paralyzes judgment. And this is how you get your elites, your most educated, to get behind this. So for now, we've been subjected to decades of Israel, Zionism, star David equals evil, mounting and mounting and mounting. And on October 7th, an placard appeared. I follow these placards for 20 years, which is why I can see various changes such as white supremacy in America in 2020. A new placard appeared. And the placard says the following. keep the world clean. And it had an image of a Star of David or a flag of Israel in a trash bin. When I saw that, I said, this is it. We are reaching the culmination, the final station of this strategy. Because when you are being told for decades, from every direction, from your most hallowed and respectable institutions, that Israel, Zionism, Star of David equals evil. Well then, what do you do with evil? Do you negotiate with evil? Do you reach a two-state solution with evil? You eradicate evil. And there comes the final idea. Keep the world clean. And this is the most ancient and most dangerous idea. That there is a clean world, a beautiful world, a world of utopia. And the only thing that stands between us and that beautiful, clean world is the collective Jew, which needs to be placed in the trash bin by any means necessary. I'm sure you've heard that after October 7th. Now, one of the greatest failures of Holocaust education is that people might go to museums and know the history of Nazi Germany and know about the death camps, but very few people will be able to say one simple idea that everything the Nazis did was downstream of a governing idea, keep the world clean. In their case, racially clean, today human rights clean, but the notion that there is a better world out there to be had. You know, many years ago, there was an American rapper, Yael Kanye, who said that Hitler thought that he was doing something good. And he got a lot of slack for that. And I remember listening to him, and I'm thinking, he said the most obvious thing ever. Hitler, the Nazis, their collaborators, their supporters, believed that they were birthing a better world. And when you believe that you are birthing a better world, and something stands in your way, then by any means necessary. I know so many of us have wondered, have been frustrated. How is it there's no empathy, sympathy for the plight of those who are suffered so many atrocities on October 7th, those who were kidnapped and tortured since? What's going on? But what's going on is by any means necessary. If you have been primed to believe before October 7th, that Israel, Zionism, and Star of David is evil, then by any means necessary. There's no sympathy, there's no empathy, whatever is needed. And here comes a kind of interesting element here. So if you notice, everything I said up until now has nothing to do with Israel. It took me a really, really long time to be able to understand that myself. Because they're saying Zionism and Israel are doing all those things, so you're thinking it's a discussion about Israel, the conflict. And we're constantly trying to prove that not this, that. You know, about 10 years ago, an Italian programmer named Brandolini coined, he was watching what's happening on the internet, and he coined something that he called the Brandolini principle, that also got the name, the bullshit asymmetry principle. And what the principle says is this, that the amount of effort required to refute bullshit is at least an order of magnitude greater than the amount of effort required to create. I remember when I read that, and I thought, that's the Jewish condition. I almost began to think of it as a Jewish tax. This is how they keep us busy. They're throwing us apartheid, racism, genocide, and we run to write books and lectures and explain, no, we're not apartheid. Look, our judges equal rights. And we're putting all this effort, but they're not engaged in a discussion about Israel. It's one more brick, one more tree in the forest that builds brick after brick to keep the world clean. So just as this is not about Israel, I will argue that this is not about Palestinians. And we're seeing it live now with the complete silence of people kind of rising in Gaza. It's not a coincidence that all the evil words are on the side of Israel, Zionism, and Star of David, and all the good words are on the side of its rejection. I've come to call that ideology Palestinianism, the singular obsession with the non-existence of a Jewish state. What words do they get? Justice, equality, freedom, rights. And then you begin to see all these posters. Feminists for Palestine, queers for Palestine, Palestine is worker rights, Palestine is climate change. And you're thinking, what don't they know how the society is organized, how homosexuals or trans people will be treated in the West Bank and Gaza? But it doesn't matter. Because again, this is not about the people living in the West Bank and Gaza. Palestine has become an abstract marker of utopia. And this sounds weird, but this is what it is. Someone recently said in an interview that the Palestinian flag has become the new red flag. The flag that represents the global brotherhood, the utopia. So if you understand that Palestine has become the global abstract marker of utopia, then queers for Palestine and trans for Palestine and Palestine is climate change makes sense. Because anything you think is utopia, you will put it next to Palestine. And anything that is evil, you will put next to Israel, Zionism, Star of David. And this is the moment that we're in. This ideology has now gained global dominance and respectability. The repetition is everywhere. The visual symbols, the emotions. And worry about emotions. So many people think that anti-Semitism is about hating Jews. And then they're like, I don't hate Jews. I'm not an anti-Semite. God's my heart. But it's not. The hate, the anger, are the outcome. They're not just pre-existing emotions. Imagine that day in and day out, you are being told that there could be a better world were it not for the collective Jew. You're beginning to be angry. You're beginning to hate them because they're standing between you and a better world. You know, a few years ago, a member of Congress, happily since ousted, Cori Bush, said that the reason that America doesn't have universal health care is Israel. Now, I think it's an abomination. I'm sure you here in Austria too think that it's an abomination that America doesn't have universal health care. There's a lot of reasons for that. None of them have to do with it. But for her, being a complete failure as a member of Congress, this is a great way to explain her failure. Because to use the very colorful language of the current American president, anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism are always the ideology of losers, sides. You know, it's always the ideology of losers, of failed societies, of societies in crisis, who are trying to find a scapegoat and reason for their failures rather than actually deal with their failures. So imagine that you have a serious member of Congress tell you that the reason that your father is not getting his cancer treatment is because of the collective Jew. Then you're going to be angry, personally angry. You're going to hate them. So the issues of hatred, anger, those emotions, that are part of mass manipulation. They don't float in the air. They are the outcome of this constant repetition that the world could be a better place. So how do we get out of this? First, by seeing the forest for the truth. That's what I try to do everywhere I speak. I was like, the UN report on this is a tree. This allegation is a tree. Everything is a tree. Look at the forest. The forest is this ideology of keep the world clean. No society has ever survived the institutionalization of that ideology and somehow came out better for it. There's no such record. You know, for many years before October 7th, they participated in these high-profile debates on whether anti-Zionism is the new anti-Semitism. And I lost it all, because the other side only needs to parade the anti-Zionist Jew. By the way, that's why they're so valuable. The more educated they are, the more articulate, the more valuable they are, because that is the way that anti-Zionism can progress. See, we have nothing against Jews. Recently, when I talked about it in Israel, someone who came from the Soviet Union told me that famous actors, artists, scientists, Jewish scientists, had to often go and talk on television and the media about the fact that Soviet anti-Zionism has nothing to do with Jews. They're Jews and it's not about Jews. When the Soviet Union fell, they came to Israel. And this guy told me that they were hounded and they had to apologize and explain that their families were threatened. But sometimes it's just about the rewards of selling out your people. It's difficult to be Jewish, and there will always be rewards for those who sell out their people. The more educated, the more articulate, the greater the rewards. So after losing one such debate in London, it was in 2019, I was deeply rattled, because when it was announced, it was a very hostile audience, this is London. And when it was announced that we lost, the glee and joy in the crowd was such that it felt a bit like a pre-pogrom Eve energy to them. It felt as if they were so happy they would just go out and break some windows. So I came back from that and I thought, this is not a debate. This was not a debate. This was not, oh, you're for tariffs, you're against tariffs, great, aren't you, and spend you. I was like, something else was taking place there. And I went home and I decided to do a different research. I was like, I'm not going to argue the hair-splitting questions of whether anti-Zionism is always the same as 19th century anti-Semitism. I was like, I'm going to ask a simple, practical, and urgent question. What happens to Jews, actual Jews, when anti-Zionism becomes the institutionalized ideology of a country, of a political party, of a place, of a university campus? And here, the historical record is definite. No exceptions. Wherever anti-Zionism rose to be official, two things happened. Step one, the environment turned hostile to Jewish life. Even as the anti-Zionists would say, we have nothing against Jews, we love Jews, they might be Jews themselves. The environment always turns hostile to Jewish life. And if it's not stopped and fought against, ultimately, no Jews are left. Now, I sometimes feel the need to clarify enlightenment the mood a bit here. When I say no Jews are left, I mean collectively. The Jewish community of Venezuela is gone, but they're very happy in Miami. And the Jewish community of Iran, Iran to today, claims to love Jews, has nothing against Jews. but the remarkable Jewish community of Iran is in LA. So individually, you might be okay, but collectively, there's no collective thriving Jewish life wherever anti-Zionism rises to be the dominant ideology, and by the way, vice versa. Jews thrive in pro-Zionist societies, and you have no exceptions. So how do we get out of here? Ultimately, Jews cannot do it alone. We are too small a people. We, as I like to say, suffer from a timing problem. What does it mean? By the time that the world wakes up to how dangerous this all is, we have often suffered the brunt of the problem. Yeah. So we have a timing problem, and we need to be aware of it, and we need to take care of ourselves until everyone else wakes up. And the other thing we need to do is to reach out for our allies. And thank you for those of you who are here today. Allies, we need to help our allies see the forest for the trees. We need to let them know how dangerous this all is. That there's no society, clearly that the Jews emerged better for it, and that the society emerged better for it. And that the sooner we put a stop to it, the better. So ultimately, what we need is allies mostly in America, in Canada, in Britain, in France, in Australia, the places where most Jews now live, and anywhere, and ultimately in the Arab and Muslim world, we need to rise up and to say, not here, not here. We will not let this ideology dominate America, dominate Canada, dominate France or Britain or Australia. Ultimately, non-Jews have to stand up and say, not here. This is what's going on, and we, until that happens, we'll need to take care of ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Anna, for this really interesting speech. I was now thinking about that anti-Semitism is always a phenomenon of the masses. And you touched that topic a bit in stating that in Iran, for example, they don't claim to be anti-Semite, but anti-Zionist. But we also have a problem, I would say, with people claiming not to be anti-Semites and actually addressing anti-Semitism when other present themselves as anti-Semites. So nobody really wants to be an anti-Semite today, but you only see the problem or the issue of discrimination and anti-Semitism in general when someone from like another political party or your opponent makes a mistake or like states a fact that is anti-Semitic. So how would you address this actually mainstream anti-Semitism? How can we counter this effect?
So we need to understand that by now, the scapegoating of the collective Jew is an incredibly powerful political weapon. Someone recently compared it to the ring and the Lord of the Rings. And as a result, I had to understand the metaphor, I had to understand if it made sense, so I sat down to finally watch the whole show. That's what we did in research. And what the metaphor wanted to say, I think it's very apt, is that this is something very powerful. It's so powerful that it's so tempting that you want to use it, but it ultimately destroys it. But the fact that what destroys you comes later. Right now, what exists is the temptation. So it's incredibly powerful. It's a powerful political tool, first of all, from scapegoating, from end failures, crisis. It's a powerful political tool to bring together people who would otherwise not be crossed together, right? The whole red-green alliance, the whole kind of Marxist-Islamist alliance can only come together through the scapegoating of the collective Jew. They have nothing else. So it's a remarkably powerful political tool. So if your political opponent has that, you don't want them to have it. But you want it for yourself. You want the ring for yourself. So you're not going to call it out. It's too on your side, you want to keep that power. But the other side, you want them to have the power, so you're never going to call it out on the other side. I will also say something more about the different sides. For many, many years, I tried to find out why, emotionally, I didn't feel too concerned about anti-Semitism coming from the right, you know, the KKK, the extreme right wing. And I really had this knot in my stomach with a kind of anti-Semitism coming from the woke, the academia, the Marxist left. I was like, what's the difference? And at one point I told myself, the anti-Semitism from the right is like crime. You know, you could be a victim of crime. But I will assume that most of your friends are not criminals. It's not your social circle. So you understand this as an external threat against which you need to take measures, but it's ultimately outside your world. Anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, is essentially like domestic violence. It attacks you in the place that you thought you were safe and home. These are the places that are homes. You know, most Jews are not members of the KKK, but they are prominent in academia, in journalism, in the places where this assault has been mounting. Human rights organizations, they established them. They wrote it. And this is where they're being attacked. But recently, I had to begin to modify that, and I feel concerned because what you're seeing in the right, and this goes back to the idea of prestige and respectability. As long as anti-Semitism in the right was kind of languishing and people writing in their basements, and, you know, it was understood to be socially at the margins. It could be lethal, it could be dangerous, but it was again like crime, socially marginal. Now it's gaining greater and greater respectability. You're beginning to get a Candace Owen, a Tucker Carlson, a Jim, like you're beginning to get more and more, and it's what they're now calling the woke right. When that becomes respectable too, that gets dangerous. The key to watch out for, instead it's a mass movement, but it never becomes a mass movement before the kind of the high priests of prestige give it a stance.
And you have no placements here in Austria. Maybe actually bringing the whole topic to the Austrian or German and Austrian situation. We have here anti-Semitism also on the far right in a very modernized way. Mostly being expressed in a very modernized way, because we have justice, and you can't openly hate Jews unless you want to go straight with law, I mean, in most parts at least. So there is this phenomenon of communicating your anti-Semitism in a different way, in a more inclusive way. Still, we have this special historical situation also, that we are in a post-Nazi country, and the Germany is as well, so we deal with a lot of guilt resentment in the Austrian and German society. What do you think, does this impact the way anti-Semitism is expressed and also fought here?
So I'll take it from two directions. The part of the rod that you say they use different symbols, different language to communicate, again, as long as this is kind of, they understand that at the margins, they understand this is socially and even legally unacceptable, and sometimes it's like fraud, it's like having organized crime. You fight it, you battle it, you research it, but you know it is, and you know it for what it is. The guilt issue, I would argue, is creating a very bizarre, and again, probably dangerous phenomenon. I don't know if you saw, again, after October 7th, a big campaign, a big placard, I think mostly in Germany, I don't know if in Austria, and it said this, free Palestine from German guilt.
Yeah, this at the campus here actually written from Austrian guilt.
Excellent. Okay. So let's talk about free Palestine from German or Austrian guilt. It requires taking apart every wrong thing that is being said here. Issue number one, one about which I've written a lot, and it's one of the things that really triggers and angers me, it's a phenomenon that I've come to call Zionism denial. Again, very apt that we're doing this in Vienna in the Faculty of Law. Zionism denial sounds like this. Unfortunately, the final solution was not so final. There were some leftover Jews. What are we going to do with them? We're going to, like, throw them into the Levant because we happen to imperially control that territory. Oh, we pushed leftover Jews in. Poor Palestinian is thrown out. Therefore, you hear that Palestinians are the secondary victims of the Holocaust. Germany or Austria owes them a particular duty. Okay, I don't think I'm cartooning this too much. That's Zionism denial. It basically presents Israel not as the outcome of the vision, the hard work, the persistence of Jews who really had the vision to create a Jewish state. And I always like to remind people, Herzl did not envision the Judenstaat so that never again. He imagined it so that never at all. So, Zionism in denial tells a story whereby Israel is some gift given by guilty Europeans after World War II. As I'm sure you know, it took a long time for Europeans to feel guilty. In some places, not even. But the notion that Israel is sometimes somehow a gift, and thereby it's a conditional gift. If the Jewish state doesn't behave nicely, we're going to take it back. They don't get to keep this gift. So, and I've come to call it Zionism denial because it denies the Jews their story, their agency. When there was 100 years to the Balfour Declaration a few years ago, I gave a talk in London. They had a conference, and the name of my talk was "Thank You, Lord Balfour. We'll take it from here." And the message was, read the Balfour Declaration. What does it say? Oh, with you, with favor, blah. If you were, if you had a startup and you went to an investor and he told you with you with favor, would you go home and spend $1 billion? No, with you with favor. If the Jews had not gone and taken action, deliberate, continuous action, to actually create their state, there would have been no state. If you read the UNSCOP, the committee that was recommending partition, do you know why they recommended partition in a Jewish state? You don't read guilt in any of their words, in any of the texts. There's no guilt. Why did you say that there should be a Jewish state? Because as we toured the country, they were like, it already exists. The Jews have already built the state, so they should have that state. So the notion that Israel was somehow given by guilty Europeans is a very powerful idea. It's one of the reasons I invested so much about writing about Herzl and telling Herzl's story, because a lot of even well-meaning people really believe that Israel is a gift after the Holocaust. If anything, it's all of the odds. So it builds on this completely missed but very powerful notion that Israel is a gift by guilty Europeans, denying Jews their agency. Then it somehow pretends that the Arabs were just, okay, so when we wrote the book, The War of Return, in English, and it came out in Hebrew 2018, by the way, we're writing now in Hebrew, we'll soon come an updated version after October 7th. So when the book came out in Hebrew 2018 and started working on the English translation, we realized that a lot of things that in Hebrew were obvious to a Hebrew reading audience, we need to explain in English. So for example, the chapter on 1948 and why Arab refugees were created as a result of the war. We again, I don't think I'm cartooning too much, we realize that today, people think that the war of 1948 looked like this. In 1948, the evil Zionists and Israelis already had the Israeli Defense Forces that even then had F-16 and tanks. At the time, they proceeded to invade the peaceful, peasant-loving country of Palestine, ethnically cleansing its peace-loving population. Again, I don't think I'm cartooning too much. So we had to actually describe what the war was like. Why it was, from the Arab perspective, a war of annihilation, and why it was a brutal war, and why refugees were created in that war. But a lot of people are not aware that the Arabs played a key role in basically trying to ensure that there's not just that there's a Jewish state, already in the 20s and 30s. You know, the Palestinians like to tell a story now. We received the refugees and they turned around and stabbed us in the back, those immigrants. I'm like, no. The Arabs, as I'm sure you know, fought bitterly to prevent a Jewish state from emerging as Herzl envisioned it in the 20s and 30s. And they were successful. Britain betrayed the mandate that it received unanimously from the League of Nations and closed the doors to Jewish immigration at the most critical time in Jewish history. And the Arabs of Palestine, those who are now called Palestinians, bear a responsibility if they had not prevented the establishment of a Jewish state, had they not led Britain to betray the mandate, the scale of the Holocaust would have been different. Some historians say hundreds of thousands, some historians say millions, but it would have been different. And the way I know it is because when the Arab world ethnically cleanses its Jews in the 1950s, only two decades later, the only difference between Europe in the 30s and the Arab world in the 50s is the existence of the state of Israel. So we could have had only an ethnic cleansing in Europe, but because the Arabs successfully prevented the state and hearts of envisioned, basically they bear a responsibility. So everything in this free Palestine from German or Austrian guilt is pretty much the opposite. And my argument is that, as I don't know the Austrian law, but I think Germany is now outlawed some of the free Palestine from the river to the sea. And people say, oh, no, and I'm like, absolutely right. Because what the Germans are now experiencing, and maybe here in Austria too, is the re-importation of the Nazi propaganda in Arabic that had tremendous impact on the creation of Palestinianism as an identity. It is now being re-imported into this place under the guise of Soviet anti-Zionism. And the sooner that they legally send it to the margins, the better.
Now, maybe one last question before we open to the public Q&A. we already touched the topic of agency, and as right now there are protests happening in Gaza, I realized that online there are already some anti-Semitic lies being spread about them. For example, the conspiracy narratives that this is all just Western media, and they're not really against Hamas, these protests, or it's a false flag action from Israel, and so on and so on. So I think these narratives, or like these ideas, are not only in themselves quite racist, because they don't give Gazans and Palestinians any agency, but also they seem to fit in your whole evil and good kind of explanation of what anti-Semitism is. But maybe can these protests also give us some hope?
So, first of all, you're absolutely right. The idea that Palestinians have no agency, the idea that they fought, that, you know, that there's a price to be paid, that they made a choice, is completely absent, typically, from the Western discussion and imagination. I'm following closely the protests in Gaza, reading everything that kind of comes out online, and I'm being very careful. Because one of the things that I've learned over the years of really understanding what the conflict is about and what it's not about is to really listen to what Palestinians are saying. What I've discovered is that to their credit, on this issue, they never lie. They rely on everything else, apartheid, genocide, famine, and open and whatever. This, they will lie continuously. Where they will not lie is on the fact that their very ideology and identity is tied up with the rejection of a Jewish state anywhere in the world. As tested in multiple ways, they do not lie. They've learned to use words like justice, rights, you know, like Students for Justice in Palestine. And you're a Westerner, you're thinking, oh, justice? They should have justice, really, as y'all should get out of the West Bank. When they say justice, there's only one justice, which is the justice that corrects the injustice that is the very existence of a Jewish kid. So they want to use a lot of words. For example, the one that really, you know, I fell for in the 90s, they said two states. They did say two states, some of them still do. We made the assumption that one of the two is the leadership. In retrospect, crazy, we should have checked. Because when they said two states, they meant an Arab state in the West Bank and Gaza, and another Arab state to replace Israel through this idea of refugee return. It's not a refugee, there's no return, but that's their vision. So I've come to be very, very careful at listening to what they said. So the protests where there is the greatest hope, let me first say what it's not. In those protests, I am not yet, leaving it open, I'm not yet hearing something that challenges Palestinians. I've come to define Palestinianism as having four core tenets. From the river to the sea, there will be no Jewish state, and we are therefore perpetual refugees. Until return. And in case anyone thinks return is some nostalgia, October 7th is the Palestinian vision of return made real. This is why there was so much for it. So I'm not hearing anything in the demonstrations that challenges those core ideas. I'm not hearing things like, enough is enough, we want to live next to the Jewish state, enough with this rubbish of we're refugees in return. I'm not hearing that. What does give hope is there are some of the demonstrations that are calling to release the hostages and for Hamas to surrender and go. That is something. We shouldn't make it into everything, but it is something. And of course, this is the thing we need to push most for. Ultimately, the tragedy of the last century, the conflict, I call it a tragedy with ceasefires. or sometimes I call it the power that the Jews are never allowed to win, the Arabs are never allowed to lose. Certainly they're never allowed to acknowledge it. We might be seeing the beginnings of something that could lead to defeat, to surrender. And defeat is a good thing. The reason we're stuck in conflict is that there hasn't been a clear moment, as has been in Europe, of clear defeat. I have to share with you, I was recently in Paris for a conversation, and if you've seen the movie Back to the Future, you remember the moment when Marty begins to understand that he's in the 50s, behind clothes and whatnot. That's what it felt like going into discussions there. So it's the 90s, it's still the 90s. You know, everyone talking, how do we solve the conflict? It's a space solution, but nothing happened. And then there, and one point again, very smug, one of the kind of the EU officials there says, what can the EU do, you know, to promote peace, improve the situation? I said, you know what? It would be really nice if the EU started by remembering how it became the EU. You know, because everyone's like, can't you just engage in more dialogue? I was like, the EU did not become the EU because you engaged in dialogue. The EU became the EU because there were some ruthless leaders that understood that Nazi Germany had to be completely defeated, unconditional surrender, millions of people deported, expelled, new boundaries established, occupation for many, many years, and then you could have time. So, if we can actually, rather than now rushing to discuss, let's stop the fighting or ceasefire, rather than have more global support for pushing the Gazans to accept surrender and defeat, something good might actually finally be out there.
I have many more questions and comments, but let's open this to the public and give you a chance to ask your questions. I think someone is going to take the microphones to bring it.
I have a question because you were saying about building or having allies. How do you see the Abraham allies? Because this is something which I see as something positive in the future, especially because those countries held in the war. Thank you.
Certainly. So I absolutely agree with you. It's a great source of some hope. Again, we need to be careful. And I'll explain why. When I say that Palestinianism as an ideology comes to die, so that Jews and Arabs can finally live, the ideology with which Palestinianism needs to be replaced, in my view, I call it Arab Zionism, which sounds crazy now, and one day we'll say, oh, he not said it many years ago. So, what is Arab Zionism? I think the last time that I was in Vienna, this is the story, I think it was here, I was participating in a panel. It was years before October 7th, and it was the usual how to get to peace and all that, and I've said what I've been saying for a few years now. Peace will happen when the Arabs, and especially the Palestinians, end their century-long war against Zionism, decide to live next to a Jewish state rather than on top of it from the river to the sea, and they're not refugees in the original region. So someone who was sitting to the left of me, both ideologically and physically, said, what? You want the Palestinians to be Zionists? And I said, yes. And then the audience kind of chuckled, and I said, I want to make my case for not. For me, to be on this panel, to be invited as a reasonable person for peace, I need to recognize the Palestinian right to self-determination in the land. I was like, why is it suddenly so crazy, such a big ask, that they recognize the Jewish right to self-determination in the land, also known as Zionism? I was like, why is that suddenly so crazy? It should be considered a base demand. So Arab Zionism is really the only path to peace, because of two simple truths from which we can never escape. One is that as long as the Jews want to be sovereign, it's in the land of Israel. Collectively, everywhere else is exile. You know, I often give talks to delegations of students who come to Israel. Just this week, delegation from Harvard. Always, always, always. I give them a talk about the history of the Jewish people, then modern Zionism, and all that. No matter, and I go through the history of our people, the connection to the land, Abraham, Exodus, whatever. And then, always someone will say, fine, I understand the Jews are our people, you have the right to self-determination, but why I'm here? When we're in Israel. And I'm like, from the collective Jewish perspective, everywhere else is exile. Individually, you can live anywhere. But collectively, the Jews are connected to one land and one land only. There's a great new book by Ben Freeman, The Jews and Indigenous People. And contrary to how most people think indigeneity is defined legally, it's not about living in a place a lot of time. That doesn't make you indigenous. Indigenous is about having your entire culture, language, calendar, rituals wrapped up with a place. And in that, the Jews are the indigenous people. You cannot mark anything Jewish without a connection to the land of Israel. You might decide to personally not do it, but it is woven through. It's why I always view it such pity. I don't know if you have it in Austria, but like in the UK, in America, in Canada, you have like Jewish voices for peace. They're not only Jews, you can see they never get the Hebrew right. But when they want to kind of show their anti-Zionist bona fides, they invite people to celebrating some Jewish holiday without Zionism. And then they contort themselves into these pretzels because you can't. So, as long as the Jewish people want to be sovereign, it's in the land of Israel. Truth number one. Truth number two. The Arab and Islamic conquest of the 7th century of the Levant in North Africa were a huge success. Well done. Which means that as long as the Jews want to be sovereign, they are damned or destined, I hardly make it destined, to remain an ethnic, linguistic, religious, national minority in an overwhelming Arab and Islamic Middle East. Nothing is ever going to change that. I always like to tell people that when Ben Gurion declares independence in 1948, the ratio of Jews to Arabs in the region was 1 to 50. Great. So he calls upon Jews to make Aliyah. Huge success. More than 3 million Jews have made Aliyah in Israel's history. He calls upon us to make babies. We make a lot of babies. I'm sure you know Israel is a free country where it's highly educated, wealthy, and has lots of kids. Great. We are more than 10 times the number of Jews we were when Ben-Gurion declared independence. The ratio of Jews to Arabs in the region today, 1 to 60. So they've been busy too. Basically, there's no amount of immigration or procreation that ever gets the Jews out of their minority status in an Arab and Islamic region, which means that ultimately the only vision of peace worth pursuing is one where the Arabs change the prism from white European settler colonialists, which are all just synonyms for foreign, get out of here, what are you doing here, to the Abrahamic vision. And view it as an integral, I would argue, the theological part of their Arab and Muslim identity to embrace Jewish sovereignty. I just know the life of Sharif. He's this influencer. He's very active online. He grew up in Saudi. He's Emirati. He was very radicalized. He changed his view. He now goes around the world promoting the Abrahamic vision. So a few months ago, Luai and I were in a conference in D.C. for Jewish educators. Now, when Luai speaks, he likes to come dressed in the Arab, you know, the garb of the desert. So you need to imagine, hundreds of Jewish educators sitting, Luai is sitting there, and he said the following. So they connected to Free Palestine from Germany. He says, if your story to me is of pogroms and expulsions and persecutions and Holocaust, I might be sympathetic. It's sad. But what do you want from me? But if your story to me is indeed that you are the people of Israel, in the land of Israel, he said that I, as an Arab and Muslim, from my own texts and identity and tradition, can embrace them. And I cherish the moment when you needed an Emirati Arab to tell Jewish educators that long before the story of one of the pogroms and expulsions, it's about being the people of Israel in the land of Israel. So this is where I see hope. I'm under no illusions. It's still a minority view of the Arab world, but it's the only vision worth pursuing.
What is your take on the Israeli government's decision currently in line with the hemisphere of ministry and the law first finally on the centers in Empire itself and right wing groups and concerning lives of the Israelis in Europe? Do you believe this is the way forward into see the law population?
So I must say, I'm less familiar with all of that. I was not involved in it. But I will say more broadly. Again, I'm no expert on European politics. I think I know enough to say that there's a whole debate on what is actually far right and what is being branded as far right just because it's, I don't know, tough on immigration or certain economic issues. I think what we need to do as Israelis is to have that level of sophistication, to be able to reach out to parties that might be branded far right by their enemies. You know, in Israel, everyone you don't like is a fascist. But you need to go and find out if that's actually true. So I think we just need to be smarter and more sophisticated about the discourse. Is this really kind of beyond the pale, or is it within the legitimate discourse? As I said, ultimately we need allies. And I think we just need to be smart about when these are true allies and when we are just enemies.
Hello. You said before about Abrahamic. I had a discussion with the Palestinian, and you were discussing exactly that, and it went in circles a lot. But then at some point he said, look, I cannot absorb your opinion, and you cannot absorb my opinion. So in other words, for me, it really connects to what you just said. And I understand correctly, because, and I thought about it so many times, because I really like this stuff. And what did he really mean? I can't feel your pain. Why is it that they cannot feel my pain and I can't? But let's be honest about this. After the 7th of October, when you know that peace fighters were slaughtered, it does something to you. So even if you could feel the pain, I can relate to what he's saying. I cannot feel his pain, and he cannot feel my pain. Is this what you mean when you say it's better not to go there at all, but to go with this? Is this what you mean?
It's actually part of it. I think what you said about going around in circles is exactly that. There is nothing good to come out of the discussion of pain and suffering. I avoid it because it leads to nothing productive. You know, there's a lot of conversations, dialogue groups that look like this. Over the years, I would say that various Jewish, Arab, Israeli, Palestinian dialogue groups look like this. The Palestinians blame Israel for everything they're suffering. The Israelis agree, and everyone goes home feeling they had a great discussion. And that's typically the dynamic. There's no use discussing kind of pain, suffering. This is why I go to the core of it. The core of the conflict has only ever been the complete Arab and Palestinian, especially rejection of the Jewish right to self-determination in any part of the land. All the suffering, everything is the result of that. Now, what I just said, you know, I have a long talk, you can look at it online, about what the conflict is and why it's not about the land or territory or Palestinian statehood, but about this one idea. When I said this over the years, when I would say, look, the conflict is, I always bring a quote by Ernst Bevin, the British foreign minister after World War II, the conflict is the Jews want to stay, the Arabs want the Jews not to have a state. I said, well, look, this has only ever been the conflict. To the credit of the Arabs, the Palestinians, they have been consistent, they said it, they acted on it, they thought it was worthwhile. Every time, I like to say that the Jews have supported every two-state solution, provided one of the two is the Jewish state, and the Arabs have always rejected every two-state solution if one of the two is the Jewish state. This is the source of all the suffering. Now, when I write, when over the years I've written, this is the conflict. The Jews want to stay, the Arabs, especially Palestinians, want the Jews not to have a state. And I would tell people, this is not, I'm not making a judgment here, this is a description. You might think that it's absolutely legitimate for the Jews not to have a state. But that's the conflict. Now, what I like is this. Over the years, when I would post this explanation, let's say on Twitter, it would look like this in my comments. The Jews, Israeli Jews, Western Jews, would say, no, Enon, it's because of the occupation, it's because of Bibi, it's because of the settlement. That's the Jews. The Arabs on my feed would be like, of course, your colonizers, racist, apartheid, go home. So what I loved about it is that the Arabs on my feed were not denying that this is the conflict. They were justifying it. They think there's no legitimacy to the Jewish state. But they were none of them had ever gone on my feet to say, no, we're not. Well, we get rid of Bibi and we have peace. No. They're all very clear about what's going on. So for me, it's much better to have a clean conversation. And again, you don't need to go in circles because to the credit of the Palestinians on this, they are not. You just sometimes need to ask them questions, but they move on. And then you go to the core of it. And if they think that it's legitimate to continue fighting for a century, that there's no Jewish state, then I don't need their recognition of my pain. I certainly don't need to recognize theirs. We just need to understand that this is what the conflict is about, and we need to do everything to kill their ideology, again, so that we might finally, all of us, live and suffer much less. But I find that this is a much more productive conversation than talking about feelings. I'll say two more things in this context. Once, I was recently in a conference, and you know, they bring these, the more sophisticated Palestinian peace activists, and they will say things like, again, to the Gail Rishiba, I don't want to be the victim of your misdirected trauma. Right? The notion being that the Jews are so crazed by the Holocaust and they're going around killing Arabs. And I'm like, no, I have more direct business with you. It's not about some, you know, Trump's Europe. But they play that as if, again, they are some innocent bystanders that have played no role the wars and the suffering that has taken place. So this is why, again, I never go to this discourse of recognizing pain and feelings, because it's always abused and misused. And maybe I'll remember the second thing that I wanted to say. But basically, I wanted to tell you a story about having your mom. So a few years ago, again, before I was 7, they speak to a delegation of American university students who come to Israel. I did my usual talk about what the conference is about, and one of the students was from Students for Justice in Palestine. I end my talk, and she says the following: "You just said that Palestinians don't want peace." Now, that's not what I said. I'm very precise with my language. I said that there has never been in the last century a vision of peace by Palestinians where there was a Jewish state anywhere to be found. But she heard that I said that Palestinians don't want peace. So she goes on to say, "That's not true. I'm a Palestinian and I want peace." Now, 99.99% of people will stop here and say, "Ha! Hey, I was wrong. I found a Palestinian, heads of the Students for Justice in Palestine, and she wants peace." But I developed a musical theater. And it was like this. I'm like, okay, what does peace look like? And what happened was fascinating. We engaged in this discussion where I pushed her. I know you're not supposed to push students these days, but I kept pushing her. And I said, "What does peace look like?" And she was like, "But Zionism is colonialism, but it's racism." And I was like, "But is there a Jewish state in there?" And she kept like doing this. She could not utter a vision of peace where there is a Jewish state anywhere to be found. And again, I much prefer these conversations that, in my view, go to the core of why we have suffering, rather than to discuss and acknowledge it.
I come from a very Zionist family. My biggest grandparents went as Zionists to Israel in 1935. And my dad was born there in 1942, and he was named after Herzl. His name is Theodor Benjamin. So we come from a very deeply connected Zionist feeling towards Israel. And what I wonder, and I cannot find an answer, is how the West explains all these billions that are spent for decades. I don't think any other ethnic group gets a VIP agency in the UN as the only refugee VIP section. That's the money. And nobody asks how they pay their bills in Qatar and their yachts. I think Hamas is one of the richest terrorist organizations. It was ranked somewhere in the Forbes magazine. This is something that is so known, because if I know about it, the government and the Brussels and everybody knows about it. And yet, there's still this politics to just blindly send money, not to check what the school books are about and the rest of it. And the next generation of Shahids is in food breeding. So there, to me, I don't really see light at the end of the tunnel, if not even peace space is tackled.
So when I started my own work and research on UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, the organization that kind of the core of, I would say, promoting and sustaining Palestinianism, I thought that I would research the facts and bring the facts, and people would be horrified. So one of the things that I'm most proud of in the book, The War Return, is that even people who are not pleased with its recommendations, dismantle UNRWA, Palestinians are not refugees, there's no right to return, even those who are not pleased with the book's recommendations have not been able to challenge it on the facts. It's unsayable on the facts, like you said. So I thought, when I started this whole process about 15 years ago, that I would come with a serious research and then a research book, and then again, that's unassailable. And diplomats in Western countries would be horrified to find out what they're funding. And then I have quotes, essays from before October 7th, telling them, look at what you're funding. You in Vienna, Paris, London will not pay the price. I will pay the price. My people will pay the price for what you're funding. And I thought, even on the official level, I was like, this is undermining your own official policy of two states. Even on that element, it goes against your official policy. And indeed, after October 7th, when I saw, even before I saw my inability to make a dent, and after, when more people clearly became interested, tragically, the fanaticism with which European diplomats, politicians have been protecting UNRWA has indeed led me to introduce a darker thought into my mind. And the darker thought is this. Could it be that it's not that they don't know what they're funding, but that they perfectly know what they're funding, and that UNRWA and Palestinianism, that also goes to the idea of Palestine as this abstract utopia, that funding UNRWA, funding Palestinianism, I mean, why have I spent so much of my life on UNRWA? Because UNRWA says at the core of the original sin that rather than tell the Arab refugees, you just waged a stupid war that was entirely unnecessary. You could have had an Arab state living next to a Jewish state in prosperity. No one would have been displaced. You waged a stupid war of annihilation because, as Bevan correctly noted, it was more important for you that the Jews not have a state than that you would get another Arab state. You went to a stupid war. You lost. Move on. Rather than get the message, UNRWA sits at the core of basically telling them, no, you didn't lose. Your victory is merely delayed. And that's what we've been going through for the last 75 years. So the darker thought that I now also entertain, some of it is inertia, some of it is ignorance, some of it is stupidity, some of it people just don't care, some of it people believe the lies, but there is also room for the darker thought that in the Kishkas of the West remains a continued ambivalence with the idea of a sovereign Jewish state, with the idea of Jews with power. And they have outsourced this kind of almost unspoken ambivalence to Palestinians. And our resurrections.
Since there's time for some more questions, I'm just going to suggest that you collect the questions and maybe raise your hands, everybody who still wants to take one. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Keep yourself short, and then you're going to have to...
You'll have to remember the form.
I will try to remember the form. Yes, go ahead.
Hi. My question is regarding what we call Palestinianism. The ideology, which I think is very widespread among the population of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. See, we talked a lot about how to change the perception of the world in this regard, but I would like to know if you see a realistic chance, and if so, how, to convince the Palestinian population and the territories to change their mind as well.
I was just wondering if your lectures differ from after 7th of October.
Do you foresee a time when there will be Palestinian Zionism? And is there any actual room for the independent Palestinian state?
We're trying hard for optimism. So the two are the bill. I'm wondering if there's a silent majority, especially in Europe and maybe also in the United States, that start seeing the threat of the Islamic population in their own countries as a threat to their life. Zion, and if maybe there is a shift of who is evil and the families might be more evil than the
people. Zion.
And in the very best.
Just a quick question about Europe. For us, it's obviously the place we live in, so it's very prevalent. But like, if you look at it from a geostrategical point of view, from Israel's point of view, in your opinion, what is the role of Europe really? I mean, with reality ever changing and the multipolar world we're living in, how important is Europe really for Israel in the long run?
So, I'll start with
them
together and then these three can talk about also
Look, Europe, of course, is clearly important in all objective measures. Our largest trading partner, scientific partner. It matters greatly, especially as long as Asia continue to reject us. This is the place where we get to sing in the Eurovision, very important. And actually, even finally belonging in the EU, we were once the absolute pariah, then we became part of the European bloc. In many ways, it's the only place that allows us to somehow belong geographically against the continued rejection. Maybe one day this will flip with the Zionism and all that, but for now, that's what we have. Europe, I don't know. Historically had this, or not historically, but for a few decades, played the notion of kind of a moral kind of compass and things like that. So it does matter what happens here, votes in the UN. But, other things are happening. India, hopefully, is becoming important. The vision that now the American president has for, a trade and energy pipeline from India through the Middle East to Israel to Europe. Who knows? There's a lot of potential great positive changes, configurations. For me, it just boils down to something very simple. We can't be alone. That's as simple as that. I will say something in this context about Islamism and kind of within Europe, the debate about immigration, assimilation, Western values, European values. I'm not in favor of everyone being defined evil. I'm not trying to get to a point where, they don't think the Jews are evil, but someone else is. That generally doesn't lead to any kind of productive or constructive policies. I do think that it's important that people will notice that much of the battle against Zionism and Jewish sovereignty, part of it lies in Islamic interpretations and sociological views of the role of the Jews. Sometimes when I talk about Palestinianism, I will always have someone come up and say, Islam, just say Islam. And I say, look, and this also goes to Arab Zionism. The reason that I can say is that, first of all, there's no doubt that Muslim views of the proper role of the inferior Jew played a key role in the violent opposition to a Jewish state, but also to the question that was here about UNRWA. By now, Palestinianism has become a toxic brain of everything that is wrong with Islam, everything that is wrong with the West. You know, people say that Hamas is an Islamist movement. There's a lot of great research, I think Matthias Gonsol and Jeffrey Herf, about the impact of Nazi propaganda on the Arab language, the Muslim Brotherhood. I talked about the Soviet influence. If you read the Hamas Charter, 50-50 Nazi propaganda, Islamism. A great liar, Hussein Abubakar Mansour, recently talked about Hamas being the children of the Fanonian decolonization movement, of the blood-soaked oppressors. So Palestinianism has become this crux of the worst ideologies that are all connected with their desire to see the collective Jew gone. So I think Europe needs to go through its own challenges. We might have some allies in this, but by and large, I'm not in favor of replacing the notion that one side is evil with another. And finally, all of this, how to change an ideology, how do we get to that? This is why I emphasize defeat. You know, we do live in a bizarre world that people really think that we're enjoying all this peace and prosperity because we had dialogue. I mean, it's really weird, but, and that's why I sometimes need to remind people. And this is something that changed a bit after October 7th, that I used it before, but after October 7th much more, is highlighting that, you know, the Japanese example, I've been quoting a lot of book that has a great title, Embracing Defeat, that basically sends the message. We live in an era, I don't know if Austria is the same, certainly in America, of everyone gets a trophy. You can't tell to anyone that they lost, you can't tell to anyone that they won, you know, everyone's together. No, there's actual value in defeat. If you look ultimately at the difference between World War I and World War II, it's this. When you mark November 11th, you mark Armistice Day. It was an armistice, a ceasefire, and I say for ceasefire. So as a result, the Nazis could begin to say, hey, we were on the way to be victorious, and that was taken from us, and everything that became part of that. So what did the Allies realize when they went to war? The Allies were determined that this time around, there would be no question as to who lost and who won. There, it would be very clear who was defeated. And not just the Japanese and the Nazis had to recognize their defeat. All their allies had to go through a process of their borders changing and paying up funds and knowing clearly that being allied with the Nazis means they were defeated. So, why is defeat so important? Think about personal loss. In both the personal and the collective life, moments of ruin, of destruction, of defeat, can actually be moments of great transformation and personal growth. But only if you take responsibility. Only if you acknowledge the connection between your ideology and the ruin, your behavior pattern, your thoughts, and the ruin that is your life. What I kept calling the terrible pattern would honor those, that Arabs are never allowed to lose or acknowledge defeat, and the Jews are never allowed to win. We need to break that pattern. Because, and that's why when you talk about what's going on in Gaza, what I fear is that we might just be going back to heaven and let's rebuild and all that. No, we need to actually use this moment of ruin, and there is ruin, and there is devastation. This is why I kind of think we need to talk about people and stuff, because yes, there's ruin, there's devastation, but what needs to happen, which seems to have never happened, is a recognition of cause and effect, a relationship between the Palestinian ideology, their actions, and their outcome. Nothing needs to be built, no dollar should be spent, until there is a recognition. Only from that can the ideology begin to change. And that's what I fear for this moment. I mean, oddly, the greatest hope of this moment is if we connect the destruction and the devastation to the ideology. You know, I was just in India at a conference. They had a Palestinian woman speak before me. I have to share with you, as she was speaking, I wrote to a friend of mine. I was like, God hates us, making Palestinians our enemies. That level of whining is unbearable. And because it was all this, like, oh, and she's going through that. And she's telling the story, my mother was at a checkpoint, and she was, like, tortured in a checkpoint. Okay. I go after her, and I tell her, and I say this. The way in which this conflict has been most bestowed, and that also goes to feelings of pain, is the inversion of cause and effect. Arabs will tell you that the conflict is because Zionism displaced the Palestinians. No. You were displaced because you went to a stupid, unnecessary war with the express goal of ensuring that there's no Jewish state, and you failed. Checkpoints. Yes, there are checkpoints in the West Bank. Why are there checkpoints in the West Bank? Because weeks and months after you could have gotten a fully sovereign state in the West Bank and Gaza, no military presence, no settlements, capital in East Jerusalem, including holy sites, you walked away and you went on a campaign of brutal massacres that before October 7th was the darkest time to live in Israel. Some of you will remember there was a palpable sense of playing Russian roulette with your life merely by boarding a bus or going to a cafe. You made that ideological choice, and checkpoints were finally the way we were able to stop you. So the notion of cause and effect finally has to be placed, and it has to be clear. Israel out of Gaza, you could have turned it to a Mara Gaza. You could have turned it into beautiful Riviera. It's a beautiful piece of land. You had everything necessary to do it. But no, instead you took all the buildings and turned Gaza into an integrated, weaponized landscape for the ideological choice, and it's the choice of liberating Palestine from the river to the city, basically no Jewish state. So this is the ruin, this is the destruction, and nothing gets built until you realize that, and finally, some transformation can be. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thanks for the interest, and also I want to thank Mizo again. Being a teacher, as you know, it's a volunteering organization. Check the screen again, I hope it's there. There's the bank connection, you want to make information to Mizo Austria. Thank you.
Eine Produktion von MENA Watch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think-Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns.